This is an interview with Tim Watkin about the Stratford Morris Tawny Horse, recorded by Ian Morris.
Thank you very much, Tim, to come in and talk about your folk custom involvement. Could I just ask you just to give us your full name, please?
My name's Timothy James Watkin.
And we are in my kitchen in Stratford-on-Avon, and I am Ian Morris. Tim, what's your background?
Well, my background is nothing really special. Grammar school, or secondary school, then went to grammar school, muffed all the A-levels. So I ran away to sea and joined the Royal Navy for 12 years. And in the Royal Navy, I did a five-year apprenticeship and became a thing known as an artificer, a sort of a man who can do anything with nothing on board ships. My specialisation was radio, radar and sonar and on helicopters. After the I demobbed, after a little holiday in the Falklands, I joined several other communication companies that were startup companies in UK. Things like Mercury Communications, Rakel Vodafone, GC Marconi, and then moved across to, there's several years with each of these companies. And each time I'm like working with microwave radios or sort of radio systems or complex communication systems. And I had a foray into actually lecturing, teaching people how to repair them. So I went from actually doing it myself to actually teaching people how to do it. That was with cable and wireless. And I was at a college down at Porthcurno until it closed, unfortunately. And they all moved up to Coventry. That brought me to Coventry, basically, this job. And I sort of found things happening in Coventry, joined other companies, I don't know how much detail you want, doing other electronic systems until I finally retired about 5 years, I suppose, ago.
Where did your interest in folk custom come in?
Folk music. When I was listening to the radio one time, and there was a guy called Noel Edmonds, and he was on the telly, what am I talking about? He's on the radio, and he has a sort of regular records or sort of spots he does. And this particular one was Steel I Span, was the group of folk singers, electric folk singers, as they're actually termed. And they sang lots of strange and wonderful songs. And before that, I was into rock, like sort of Supertramp and stuff like that, heavy metal. And I sort of heard this Maddie Prize voice, and it's sort of, wow, that's a fantastic, clear voice, and the way she intones everything, and then the songs themselves, the melodies, and then I thought, I must find out more about this, and I found out, looked at the lyrics and things, and it's lyrics about some of them are quite horrible, like killing babies with pins and sort of eating dead knights who are hanging on gibbets and things. And I thought, well, this is weird, you know. But the melody, it was the thing, her singing and the singing of her and Tim Knight. They were sort of a duo at the time. And I basically followed them. King Henry was another one, because Steel I Span went through several iterations over 30, 40 years. I mean, they're still going now. And I suppose I followed them around wherever they went. You know, I got a ticket, went there, saw Worcester and Portsmouth and things. There was one memorable time. I was sitting down with my parents just outside Evesham, having a meal with them. And then they were saying, oh, what are you doing now? You know, we know you go to lots of folk things. You know, aren't you going to see Maddie Pryor sometime? Because they make a joke of me following her around. I better explain that in a minute. And I said, oh, yeah, yes, I've got a ticket for such a night. That's tonight. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. So I actually missed the concert. And through all these songs, listening to these folk songs, when I joined the Navy, you move away to things like, I was in Fareham, stationed in Fareham for a while, and they had a folk club, and I wandered into the folk club there. I thought, I wonder what it sounds like, you know, in these folk clubs, you know. And there I heard another wonderful sort of singer, female singer again, June Tabor. Now, she's from Warwick, actually. Used to be a librarian. And I just, you just saw the girl standing there, and this guy was giving her a bit of hassle. Like, I thought, why is he winding this girl up? You know, she's doing nothing, and she's looking at these notes. And it was the words. I didn't realise that. Goes to the front, starts singing. Wow, what another fantastic voice, and wonderful songs. And I think, and she was singing one of the songs about the eating of the dead body on the on the gibbet. And I thought, that's a real one. It was just sort of, yeah, I must come to teach each week. So each week I went to the folk club in Fareham, I didn't actually sing or anything. I just listened to the songs, you know, and the different people that came in. And I thought, this guy's singing something. I can't quite recognise what it is. It's something I've heard before and I liked it, but what on earth is it? And then I realised he was murdering one of my favourite songs, which Maddie Pryor used to sing, or did sing. And it was "You Jacobites by Name," which is a sort of a story about the rebellion in Scotland. And what he was doing to it was absolutely terrible.
How did that move you to going to...
Well, I thought, I can do better than that. Anybody can, even a strangled cat. So I sort of started singing little bits and pieces in the in the shower or whatever, or in the bathroom where there's some good acoustics or whatever. And I when I went back home to sort of weekends, you know, back home where I went, I used to go to folk clubs there and listen to things. And there was when I left the Navy, finally, I hadn't started singing by then, but I'd been just an avid follower of all these songs. And I've been following Maddie Pryor different places where she was singing, and she used to also come down afterwards, after she's done her gig, and shake hands and talk to whatever. And I said, excuse me, Maddie, but you know, I've been following you for several years and all these different places, but where do you get the songs? Where do they all come from? The words, all that, and the melodies and things. Oh, she said, that's most of them are from Childs. I thought, Childs, what on earth's Childs? And she said, Childs, like, idiot, don't you know what Childs is? It's a collection of songs collected by Childs from America, Appalachian things. Look it up. Okay, went Coventry, not university, library, that was it. And I went in and said, excuse me, kind sir, I'd like to have a look at a book you've got here on your list, you know, Child's Ballads. I only thought it'd be a little one, about 15 or so songs. And he says, all right then, went away, come back with a trolley. And there was 10 big, thick volumes sat on this trolley. Ah, which ones do you want, he said. Well, all of them, I suppose, yeah, you know. So I wheeled them away and started riffling through them. And it was amazing. You know these ballads, you've heard them being sung, and you look up the index and there it is. And you go to it, hang on, there's not just one version, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 different versions and explanations of where it was collected and who sang it and whatever. This is amazing. And then you go to another one you know, and there's 15 versions of that one. You think, good grief. Because you only think when you heard this one song, that's it. It never changes, but it's not. They're all derived and changed, and people add bits
in. So your first event that you went to?
It was a folk club, actually. When I left the Navy, I moved up to near Coventry, and there was two sort of local folk clubs, and I sort of went in there, and they just sort of look at you and like, well, hello, come in, whatever, and people sing, and said, do you want to do it? No, thank you, just pass on, whatever. I just was sitting there and doing nothing. And I thought, I'll have to join in on this. And I noticed a thing in the paper of Find Your Voice. I think it was a folk magazine or whatever. And it was Find Your Voice. And it was a course, a day's course or whatever. It's not sort of a huge one, at Newcastle University. And basically you go up there and find your voice if you want to sing. So I thought, well, why not? So whenever it was, I sort of hopped on my motorbike, thrashed up to Newcastle, found the university, you know, booked in or whatever, and discovered that Newcastle brown ale is not drunk by Newcastle people at all. They're all drinking lager because I was in a pub there. So, bottle of Newcastle brown, please, in Newcastle, yes. And they sort of found the food I ordered. They sort of found me straight away, even though the place was full of Newcastle United supporters. There's a match on at the day, I didn't realise, and there's Newcastle supporters everywhere. And they said, how did you find me? He said, oh, you're the only one drinking Newcastle brown.
So can I take you to the very first folk event that you went to that got you into
this
where
would
you
have
are now?
Been this Newcastle one. Because you go to a thing, the room, and they say, right, you want to sing. And everyone's going, yeah. No, what's that? You all want to sing, don't you? You want to make a noise. Yes, right. That's the first thing we're going to do. We're all going to walk around and make really, really stupid, idiotic noises at each other at all volumes. Now, the reason this is to make an idiot of yourself. Once you've done that, you can sing to anybody. Once you can become a complete idiot to all the people in the room, you can sing. Okay, so we did. We started making all these noises and things and whatever. And they got us sort of trying to sing along to sort of simple rounds and things. And because you'd already made an idiot of yourself and made all these stupid noises, you didn't feel a problem of making an idiot of yourself again because you'd already done it. You'd got over that hurdle. So they said, right, now you've got over this hurdle, what you need to do now is go away and find your song you like and just practice it. Just practice it and then go and perform it. In a folk club, just or to your friends or to your family, wherever you feel comfortable that you want to sort of bring out your voice. But you've taken the big step, you stood up in front of all these people, we've all made lots of noises, we've all made idiots of ourselves, you've done the worst. The worst that can happen now is you forget the words and you just say things like, I've forgotten the words. Or you read the words off something, or you've forgotten the melody and you say, I've forgotten the melody, and someone will help you. But you've taken the first step.
So that first step got you into performing a song.
Yeah.
Interesting folk. I know because you've told me that you're a member of the Shakespeare Morris and you're the Tawny Horse. I know you're the Captain of the Mummers, Welsh Border Morris, and you've been the Green Man also in Stratford here.
Yes.
That's quite a jump.
This has nothing to do with folk music.
How did that happen?
I was happily following folk music, and for example, at this Newcastle thing, there were two singers there, or violinists, Nancy Kerr and Eliza Carthy, absolutely fantastic violin players, and they led me down another path of sort of listening to people playing the music and singing it, because before I was just listening to people just purely. I was just interested in singing. So I was at a folk club in locally here, sort of Bretforton it was, the Fleece. Now there, it's a local folk club, all sorts of people are there singing all sorts of things. It's a sort of whoever's there jumps in, sings something, and then it's someone else's turn. And I was sitting there drinking my beer, and I was hearing someone muttering about free folk concert tickets or free folk festival tickets. With a super duper bat hearing, you think, oh, right, what's this then? And it was one of the other singers, a guy called Alan Whitbread, who's sadly passed now. And I said, excuse me, are you talking about free tickets to a folk festival? How do you get one? And he said, well, you have to do something for us. I said, yes, okay, right, what do I have to do? Well, have you heard of pantomimes? Yes, I've heard of pantomimes, yes. Well, if it's a mini pantomime we do, only lasts about 20 minutes, and you just walk on, say some words, you're in a costume, and then you walk off again. Do you think you could handle that? I said, well, yeah, I've done silly pantomimes when I was in the forces, and sort of sods operas, as they call them. I said, yeah, not a problem. He said, oh, okay then, right. We've got you a ticket for the Bedworth Folk Festival then. There you go. So, and I didn't know his background was amazing. He was actually a member of Shakespeare Morris. He was the captain of Shakespeare Mummers. I didn't realise it at the time. I'd just seen him at different places. I'd met him at other folk events. Oh, I'd seen him. I'd seen him to sort of like nod at him because he sang sea shanties and things like that. And he's... friendly enough guy, although some people sort of took umbrage at some of his comments he didn't take fools gladly. So anyway, I just thought he was a folk singer. You know, didn't know anything about Morris. Nothing about Morris. I didn't follow Morris dancing at all. If I saw a Morris dancer, I'd think, oh, look, a Morris dancer, and carry on my way, you know. So
did that lead you to joining the Mummers?
Well, yes, I joined the Mummers. So I came on as a walk-on, well, they all walk-on parts, but over several years, I liked it. It's a daft thing to do. Basically, this was done at a folk festival, and he says, well, if you want to stay with us, we actually do it during the winter as well. But we do it as a method of raising money, raising funds for Shakespeare Morris. What do you mean? Well, I'm in the Shakespeare Morris, and we have to practice, all the dancers have to practice during the year. So when we go out 1st of May or whatever it is, until September, when we dance, we're all, you know, tickety-boo and can do all the dances. But we've got to practice somewhere, and we've got to pay for the hall. And you either pay for it via subs, which is really expensive if you take it all out of that, or you have the Mummers. We go around several pubs over about 8 or 9 nights between November and December, three pubs a night, do the play, collect money at the end of each performance, and that goes into the pot for the Shakespeare Morris to, you know, pay to a place to practice dancing. So I thought, yeah, that's good enough. Yeah, I don't mind that. And also, you know, we're in a pub, we drink beer, socialise. Oh, great, right. So that's what I did.
So that started the journey of the Mummers.
So that took me about 3 or 4 years. I was just doing that. I didn't go and see the Morris dancers at all because I didn't dance. I would have liked to have danced, but due to a car crash that I had many moons ago, I've got a missing left kneecap, so that left leg fatigue quickly, and the right ankle is partly crippled. It doesn't fully articulate. And so you can't prance, you can't push off on your ankles because the stepping that you do, it's all ankles and knees. So I did try it one time, but I just collapsed in a heap. So I didn't bother. I just arrived during, saw them at the winter months. And then what happened was one of the guys who was, I drew on the members of the Morris side to be the actors. I took over the mumming because the other guy, he retired effectively and now he's passed on. And one of the guys who I sort of assisted me in my first year as captain of Mummers was one of the other guys who'd been doing it a couple of years. And he was actually what they call the bagman of Shakespeare. So he's an organiser of all the events. So he knew all the pubs. And I said, well, look, I need to do a mumming tour here. And I've no idea what the pubs are locally, effectively. Because, you know, I was always coming down to do the mumming from Coventry, where I was still living. And I didn't know the Shakespeare area, really, the Stratford area. So he said, well, you should come along to the meetings, you know, when we dance. I said, well, yeah, come on. So he dragged me into the Shakespeare dark confines of actual practice night. And I said, well, this is Tim. He's the captain of Mummers. Because some of them had never seen me. You're only out of the 30 members of the side, as it were. Perhaps only 5 or 6 of them do the mumming. The others don't at all. So they would never have seen me. They knew that mumming took place, but they didn't get involved in it, so they sort of didn't know it. So I went along a couple of times, said, well, you should come out when we go dancing. Okay then, right, so I went out with them when they went dancing. Didn't have any Morris kit, whatever, just wore a mumming kit. They're dressed up, well, I've got to dress up, otherwise I look like a normal human, don't I? I make like a punter. So, and still, here, hold the coats, you know, okay, mind the sticks, okay, right, you know, sort of. And then they said, well, actually, if you want to do a bit more, we have other things. Well, what's that then? We've got animals. Animals? Oh, yes, we've got a bear. We've got a bear, the Warwickshire bear, you know, and it's a bear costume.
How did that make you feel when they mentioned that?
I thought, well, yeah, I wouldn't mind a crack at it. I mean, it's a pain in the neck just standing around holding the coats, you know, and at least you'd be taking part in the activities, as it were. And they said, well, what do you have to do with it? Well, basically, you put on this costume and someone leads you around, normally the fool or somebody, and you collect money. That's the other thing. Yes, you've got to blog black people for money, or bottling, as it's called. So I thought, Yeah, it's no different from going around with a hat and saying, you know, alms of the poor or poor Morrisman or whatever. So went out one Worcester time with this bear thing, and it sort of it was made basically based on a haversack, very badly on a haversack. And I put it on, and it was in the evening, it was getting dark anyway. I couldn't see a damn thing out of the thing. Is that the Hessian sort of front on it was just useless. You can't see your feet. And the worst thing you can do is try to find a pavement and you don't realise it's there and you trip up and, you know, apex over elbow. And I thought, and it's bloody hot inside it as well. And I thought, this is, and it's uncomfortable. And I thought, oh, this is. And where we were dancing as well, no one was really paying any attention to it. Well, I couldn't tell actually, because I couldn't see what was going on. But also the money collecting device on it, which is the reason I was there, was broken anyway. The jaw just held, was hanging open, the spring had gone. And a bit of vacuum tube, which used to disappear into a bag, which people feed money in your mouth, didn't go anywhere. So people,
that then moved on to.
Well, I thought this is a waste of space, really. And he said, "Well, we've got a horse. What do you mean you got a horse? We've got a hobby horse. Oh, what's that like?" And thinking, well, the state of the bear, it wasn't. It's a bit threadbare. It's seen better days. Jeff's got it in a minute. Yeah, we'll get it off Jeff. So the current or groom or whatever you want to call it, the keeper of the horse. I said, well, why isn't he riding it round? You know, I've been out quite a few times now, and I've seen Jeff, but he's never with the horse. Oh, he's always the fool. Well, why doesn't he do the horse? It's up to him, you know, it's up to him when he brings the horse out. Well, unfortunately, Jeff died. We had a sort of a wake at a pub for him, you know, a dance out, whatever, to see him off. And it was an amazing event of all these Morris people coming up. And we brought the horse in, or Matthew brought the horse in and put it there just as a tribute. You know, like, this is what... Jeff used to ride about, and there are pictures of him actually walking in it, whatever you want to call it, carrying it, I think that's the best expression, through the streets of Stratford. So I've actually seen a picture of him doing it. At that time he was wearing sort of a black tail coat and a bowler hat on it, and he had sort of fake Morris man legs hanging on the side. And
you and the Tawny House, how did that come together?
Well, I sort of looked at it and thought, oh, that's a bit of a state. Who on earth wants to, you know, have a go with that? And I don't know how it happened. I think we were going to have an open day. That was it. To attract more members. So it was just at the race course at Stratford. And I thought, well, if there for the day, we want to show people things. So I said, well, okay, I'm Captain of Mummers. I can bring along a load of mumming kit. And I think he said, well, we'll bring the horse along as well. We'll sort of be there and, you know, beaver about and see if anyone's interested enough to turn up and actually try dancing. So we had an open day and the horse was just sitting there. Like abandoned, like it is over there on the seat doing nothing, and I was sort of because I'm not dancing and all the mummy kit's just lying there, I'm not doing any mumming or whatever, I just sort of wandered across to it and sort of idly gave it a once over from a, I suppose, a costumier's point of view, like, oh, what's it made of, you know, what the hell have they done that, what's this then, and Matthew said, are you interested in it then? And I said, well, it needs a bit of work on it, doesn't it? I mean, this is hanging off, and that this is threadbare, and the way that, well, I'll try it on. So I tried it on, and it was horrendous. I would say horrendous.
How did it make you feel when you put it on?
I felt like, what can I do to improve it? That's what my thought was. I wasn't sort of embarrassed about wearing it or anything, because after I've been doing all the mumming and all the kit I've been wearing and the various characters I've been sort of done up in and the words and everything, you know, it's just another costume, basically. Just another costume without any words.
So you've now become the Tawny Horse for Shakespeare Morris.
Yes.
What I'd love you to do is describe everybody, for everybody, what it actually is that you're riding, wearing, etc.
Right.
And what you've done to it that's altered it from when you took it over.
Well, when I took it over, this is the second tawny horse that Shakespeare's had. The first one was in the 70s, and it was made of plywood. But this one, I don't know what happened to it. No one ever told me. But this one, it's got quite an interesting story, because it's made of wickerwork, basically. So if you imagine a big washing basket, an oval washing basket with the bottom kicked out, and then on that you've got an extended tube sort of for the neck, and on the end of the neck you've got a head attached. Now, the head was made by one of our members, one of our sort of founder members. He's our president, Tony, because he's a woodworker. He's a woodworker. And it was made out of, he had some wood, or he's made up this head. So he carved it out and sort of did the horse's head. And then he gave it to someone who will make up the wickerwork. Now, the wickerwork was actually done by a blind guy, a guy called Russell Rogers of Littleton. Unfortunately, he's also passed now. And he made the wickerwork basket and attached the neck. I thought they were two separate pieces, but it's a wickerwork basket, and somehow he's managed to interleave the ends of the neck into the wickerwork body, as it were, and it's you can't take it apart. It's solid. And then the head has been put on the end of the neck. Now, the beast itself, it was painted green. Well, the head was painted green. It's now a chestnut colour, because when I took it on, when I saw it lying there dilapidated, I thought, would you mind if I tidied it up a bit? And the green was a bit horrible looking anyway. And also the wickerwork neck, you couldn't see because it had frills all over it, and it looked like one of those fringed lizards. So so you didn't see the neck at all, and I looked at it, and when I looked at it deeply, I thought, well, that's got a beautiful bit of work in the wickerwork. I mean, that's artistic, that is. And it's a lovely colour, so I'm going to do away with the frilly bits, take the head back to its sort of plain wood, and then stain it the same colour as the wickerwork. It's got a brush at the moment, and that is a brush, a yard brush on its head, as for a mane. Before, it had a bit of straggly wool which had fallen off over the years or whatever.
And that came from where?
What, the horse?
No, the brush.
Oh, the brush. Oh, a B&Q, I think.
Okay. And the
I just went down to B&Q, brought a brush, a head brush, cut a bit off it. So a bit on the top for the mane, and then a bit on the front for the forelock.
And you put a bridle there?
Yeah. Well, the bridle, there was a sort of a leather arrangement on the thing, but it didn't look right. And I used to ride horses before I had the accident, so I knew what a bridle should look like. And I had a word with my sister, who also used to have horses, and I said, Lynn, have you got any bits of horsey stuff that you don't want? I'm after leather, you know, braces and head... bridle stuff. Oh, yeah. Well, you can have a set of reins, and I've got some traces here, or whatever. So I thought, okay, yeah. So the reins are actually real reins off a horse. The other leather work that I've done there, I've sort of tried to make it the same as a horse's bridle, just use large press studs and things, because, you know, my wonderful skills and dexterity with sort of mechanical things.
I noticed that you'd wear the basket,
right?
The head would be in front of you.
That's right.
Now, and then you'd wear what else?
Well, the head, they didn't stop at the head, unfortunately, because when I tried wearing it, I found it was just unusable. That's why no one wore the damn thing, because the strapping that it all hangs on the shoulders, and all the weight, of course, is in the head, and the strapping meant that no weight was being taken by your body apart from the wickerwork basket. And so if you were out in the horse, you always had to hold the head up with the reins. And if you're doing that for 45 minutes, just holding the head up, it gets very painful on the arms. So that's the time I said to Matthew, do you mind if I modify this horse and make it more usable. And he said, do with it what you wish, you know, within reason. So so basically I took it away, stripped all the kit off that was on it till it was down to its bare wickerwork, and thought, right, how's the best way to make this work now? So I had some 58 pattern webbing left over from when I was in the Falklands. So I utilised that to hang the bodywork on, but it still wasn't balanced correctly. So one of the other Morris members, he's a mummer as well, he used to dive. So I managed to borrow a couple of, well, I stole actually, some lead weights off him. So there's a couple of lead weights in the back to balance the head. So now when you put it on with this yoke arrangement, whatever, it balances it all nicely. You've got the weight distributed on your shoulders, you've got the head balanced by the lead weights at the back, and you can take your hands off the reins and it's still stable. That means you can now interact with the public, because before you couldn't.
And I noticed that you then got material over the wicker body and some boots.
Yeah, now because it's a tawny horse, a tournament horse, it was supposed to look like a medieval tournament horse, where you've got the armour on the horse is covered by a comparison or compraison or something. I can't remember the actual term of it, but it's basically a cloak over the horse. And the job of that is to sort of, I suppose, show the colours of the rider originally. So it's got a sort of a medieval-y sort of effect. It's a curtains material, I believe it is, but I have seen some horses with proper curtain material, and it looks like curtain material. This doesn't. This doesn't look like curtain material.
So coming back to you... go on.
And then the legs. Some tawny horses don't actually have rider's legs on them. Some do, some don't. This horse did have some rider's legs on, but they're a Morris Dancer legs, so it's like little short legs with little boots on and some bells. And I saw this picture of the original Bidford Morris men around about 1910. And they're all stood there, and their horse is there, and the guy, he's dressed totally different. He's not wearing a bowler hat, and he's not wearing a black tail coat. And he's got different shoe or boots hanging from it. And I looked into the history of the horse itself, and there was the guy who actually dragged the Morris, the tawny horse into Morris, a guy called Darcy Ferris. He put together a Bidford and Morris side in 1885, and he described how everything should be, because he was doing a revival.
So what is a tawny horse? And what's its role in Morris?
Well, to annoy people, basically. Although if you get other horses, because there's quite a few different types of horses, there's like the Mary Lloyds, who are just meant to
Let's stay on your horse.
So it's not meant to be an evil sort of ethereal horse. It's not meant to be a sort of a what they call a like I'm thinking of the Padstow horses. You're meant to put a lady underneath there and you impregnate her. You see, you hide the lady underneath, whatever. This basically is to go and clear an area for the dancers. That's what its job was. Darcy Ferris decided, which is what the purpose of the horse is, clear a space for the dancers, move all the crowds out of the way, and then when there's a rest, you know, when the dancers want a rest, the horse comes out and sort of entertains or goes up and talks to the assembled populace and whatever, and also collects contributions. You know, money and whatever.
So that's the horse. Now we've got who you are and your particular costume that you wear as the rider.
Yes.
Would you be kind enough to describe the jacket and why that jacket?
In the old pictures of the tawny horses, the guy is always wearing some sort of military jacket. He definitely looks military. When I saw this horse and the pictures of when Jeff Watkins was, no relation, just doesn't have a similar surname, when he was riding, he just wore a black tail coat and black bowler hat. And I thought, well, if you go back to the Bidford sort of tradition, and that's what Shakespeare Morris is trying to continue, is the Bidford Shakespeare, the Bidford Morris tradition, the horse should also go back to the original, you know, the horse. And the original horse was the one by Darcy Ferris, a tawny horse. And it was a sort of, the rider was in military garb. So I thought, right, I will get military-ish garb. Now, the guy, Jeff, who did used to ride it, he was also the Fool. And as part of the Fool, he used to wear a red jacket. And this jacket was Royal Canadian Mounted Police. He rode it everywhere, or he wore it everywhere. He's with a couple of different sizes, and he was never out of this jacket. And then he took to wearing the jacket when he's on the horse. So I thought, oh, okay, fair enough. So anyway, when he passed and whatever, and it was his jacket, so I didn't get given the jacket at all. I had the horse, and the decision was for me to decide what to wear on it. I had a black tail coat, you know, I had a black top hat, and I thought perhaps I should go with that. No, I'll go military again. Yes. And the Jeff's widow happened to give me some stuff for the mumming. And one of the things she gave me was this coat. And it's a tail coat, but it's sort of like a, not quite a harlequin colour, but it's got green and yellow panels and red outlines and things. And the red, I thought, well, that's the colour of Shakespeare, Morris, because that's in our colour scheme. The green and yellow is also from the Bidford tradition, and also we've got a bit of it in the Shakespeare tradition. So that would do to wear on the horse. It's big enough, luckily, because he was a big chap, just like I am. So you can wear it. It'll hide the harness. Also, you can put some legs on it. It'll hide where the legs come out as well. So I'll do that. I'll wear this. Now, it's absolutely plain when I got it, but I thought, I've got to make it military. So basically, because Jeff had this Royal Canadian Mounted Police jacket, I thought, as it was his jacket, and he was a groom, I'd continue the sort of military policey sort of themey thing. But I've got an Australian police badge on the shoulders. So it's actually New South Wales or somewhere other. I can't exactly remember where. And then it still wasn't military enough. So I put some stripes, some sergeant stripes on the shoulder, on the sides, on the shoulders. And then it's still not enough military on it. I thought some shoulder pads, like epaulets, because quite a few of them, these epaulets have got lots of these bits of string hanging off and all sorts of things. That does look a bit straggly, like a commissionaire's, called a commissionaire's sort of outfit. But I had a pair of boards which I managed to swap with a Moscow State policeman in another thing that I used to do. And I thought, well, what am I going to do with these? They're blue colour. They've got Russian badges on them. But yeah, they'll do. I'll stick them on the top. So I've actually put them on the shoulder pads on the top. We got the sergeant stripes on the sleeves. You've got the Australian police badge on the shoulder. And then also, on this Royal Canadian Police jacket he had a... marksman's badge. So I thought, aha, I have a marksman's badge. So I put a marksman's badge on one end of the sleeve. On the other, I put a drum, because another thing I got stitched up with was playing a tabor on the horse, which is no one else. I have not seen any other tawny horse or any other horse play a drum while they're being a horse. As I used to play the drum in the one of the volunteer bands when I was in the Navy, I thought it was apt. So now then, I've got the horse I can put on. I can take my hands off. It won't sort of collapse on me. I can hold the drum, play the drum, as it were. And then they give you the money box, collect money. Leaflets, hand out leaflets. Oh, no, I haven't got enough hands. So I thought, right, the horse needs to be modified. So, collecting box. I made a slot in the horse's mouth and got one of the guys to make up a collecting box which would just slot sideways into the horse's. So the horse is clenching it in his teeth. And that's great because the little kids just love putting money in the horse's sort of collecting box. And it takes all the effort off me to collect your money. So I can actually sort of play the tabor, you know, along with the rest of the musicians when the dancers are dancing. When they're not dancing, I can just wander around and talk to the sort of people and hand out information leaflets about Shakespeare and Morris, sometimes just sort of, I'd say frighten them, but to come up behind them, they don't realise you're there, and they sort of realise there's a horse behind them, and they sort of, especially the foreign tourists, they go, what on earth?
So you've also brought in a sash.
Oh yeah, the sash.
You've also brought in a straw boater. Could you describe those
colours
and why you wear those?
Right, the normal Shakespeare Morris kit for the dancers is a white shirt with a sash, this double sort of sash on it, or we call it a baldric. So it's a yellow stripe one side and a black stripe the other, and on the stripes you've got red edging. So all the members of the side wear this sort of double sash thing. Also, boaters, we wear these. It's an Olney straw hat, and then you've got to, when you buy the Olney, you've got to actually steam it and then bend the sides of the brim up, and then once it's sort of dried a little bit, you lacquer it, many coats of sort of clear lacquer. Then you've got to put the headband on it, or sort of which you make from sash material, basically, well, ribbons. You can sort of weave it around, looks like a sort of layered it, you can twist it, you can plait it or whatever. I've actually done a sort of had a sewing machine, so I actually made a sort of a vertical panel sort of effect on it. But everyone does to the hat what they want to do. It's their bit of personalization. And then on the hat as well, you put badges from various Morris events you've been to, or things that you follow, or all sorts of odds and sods. I've got in there, for example, sort of the Shakespeare badge, meaning it's 60 years of Shakespeare Morris. I've got a Vale of Evesham festival event badge, 2019, Saddleworth Rush Cart, an event up there, 2017. Even got a bell ringing, 70 years, the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, 70 years bell ringing there, because I'm a bell ringer. Fly Navy, because I'm ex-Royal Navy. Allied Armed Forces sort of veterans badge. What else we got here? Oh, helicopter, because I used to work on helicopters.
So, realistically, this is... you're following the Shakespeare Morris tradition of having animals.
Yeah.
You are a tawny horse with them. And then what you've done is personalise the individual horse for yourself.
Yeah, because the horse itself, it can't wear a sash or anything like that. So normally on the bridle, in fact, I've taken them off at the minute, I've got some of these leather badges that for the Shakespeare ones and a couple of others. Like got their lone Morris badges, that's during the COVID thing, to go on the bridle, because the rest of the Shakespeare kit is quite plain. It's just black breeches, white socks, long white socks, and the only other difference is the actual dancers get bells. They get bell pads. So as I'm not a dancer, I have no bell pads.
So something that's come out from that is one of the badges you've got is the lone Morris. St. George's Day 2020, and you mentioned COVID.
Yes.
What impact did that have on the group and yourselves?
Wiped us out, because you couldn't meet, weren't allowed to meet. So I think it was no more than three people could meet at a time, whatever, which is no good for Morris practice, because you need six people to dance. Then you've got musicians, perhaps two or three of them, and a hobby horse wandering around. No, you're not allowed to do it. So we had to come up with a cunning method. So we actually, if we didn't practice, because some sides just didn't meet for 2 years, and then getting them back into it again, terrible. So we thought, we'll try to keep it all together. We will go out and practice in the open, but only three people at a time with one musician. So you had to roster for when was your day or your particular hour in the evening. You know, you can practice in that hour, and then you have to push off because someone else is turning up for this hour, and then we'll practice. So it's actually, we were practicing in empty car parks. Now, we also, for St. George's Day, we would normally dance out as a side somewhere, and we thought, well, we've got to keep the tradition going somehow. How on earth can we do it? So we thought, well, everyone's doing Zoom. So what we do each person goes and dances somewhere to the same music. So, and then we'll put all the videos together, and then that's it. That will be our dance out. So the particular badge shows you about sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, about 9 or 12 different panes, and each one would be a different Morris person of the side doing their little particular dance to the same music. So how the guy actually choreographed it is amazing. So he put it all together, put it on the box, on the magic interweb thing, and it's there available to see. And you sort of watch everyone together, you know, even though you weren't. So my particular bit was dancing by myself with a hobby horse on Lower Quinton Village Green in front of the pub, which was closed.
So how does you being a hobby horse and being a member of this, how's it impact on your life?
Oh, it's terrible. I no one should ever do it. No, you get pulled into all sorts of strange, weird and wonderful things. Like enjoying yourself and going out to different places and visiting lots of pubs and drinking beer. And I joined it for the women. I'm still waiting for that to happen. No, it's we have ladies in our side as well. We used to be just the men's side, but now because everyone's just all getting too old, to keep it going, we've opened up to ladies now. So we're a mixed side. And so you just meet lots of different people who want to socialise in this mad way and go to different events. Some of them aren't really into folk at all, and they don't do folk music. Like some events you go to where you go and meet another side and dance with them, whatever, and you go into the pub afterwards. All the musicians, some of them they just go, but some musicians stay, and some of the other dancers just, you know, we're singers. So we have a little folky sort of singing session.
So that leads on to folk traditions now and the future. Not necessarily just Morris, but Beasts and so on. How do you think at the current moment everything's thriving, changing, dying, diluted, or where do you think it is?
The folk scene, you mean, or Morris itself? Morris, I can look at it from a couple of points of view, I suppose. One from the mumming, how that's been changed, and that's been changed due to the sort of the Black Lives Matter problems and sort of darkening your faces and that sort of thing. It's actually caused some mumming sides to sort of stop doing what they're doing or evolve into flamboyant ways of painting their faces, which is not traditional, but you've got to do what you've got to do. As it is, we keep with dark green from black, so black is right out now, and red's right out. You can't do yellow. It's quite blue, I think. You look like a Smurf, don't you? Anyway, so the mumming, we kept that going, but it is getting more difficult to do mumming in different events because a lot of the pubs since COVID, a lot of pubs have changed. They changed from pubs where they're happy to welcome you in, you do your silliness in there, and they say, "Yeah, well done, thank you very much." Everyone joins in. To no, we don't allow that sort of thing going on anymore. You'll disturb our diners or whatever. Oh no, can you come back sort of in an hour's time when everyone's left?
So does that mean that where you now perform has changed?
Well, it's getting more and more difficult to find places to perform, especially the mumming, because what we're doing for the mumming is we're collecting money for the side for somewhere to practice, you know, pay for a place to rent. Other mummers' sides, they might do it for charity or something, or others might just do it at sort of, for example, I've just lent some kit to a local side or local group that want to do a mummers' event at their fete. And I said, well, yes, you can borrow anything you like, you know, and I'll help you with anything you like. And oh, we only just want to do it for the fate, and that's it. We're going to do it about twice, three times maximum, and that's it. We're not doing it anymore. Okay, fine. So I was supporting that. On the Morris side, because you've dropped like several years after the COVID of dancing, because we did keep dancing going, we did keep that impetus there. But we did lose a couple of people, but we have gained new people, luckily, who have come in and they're learning the trade, as it were. But it's getting, again, more and more difficult to sort of find places to dance, because you need space. And some of the pubs we're going to go to this weekend, because it's the Evesham Morris Festival, where actually all you've got is the pavement outside the pub, which isn't very good if you've got six men and possibly, you know, other sides and the musicians there to dance on the pavement. It's just not enough room. So it's finding venues. We normally dance on the Bancroft in Stratford, where there's lots of space there anyway, so it's not a problem for that. But that's our normal dance spot anyway, the Bancroft. Been dancing there for what, 40 odd years now, so they're getting used
to
us.
So that now goes on to, how does the group promote themselves going forwards and currently?
We try open days. We've tried various types of open days, to differing degrees of non-success, for want of a better term. Men don't seem to want to turn up at all. Women turn up, and we have luckily got a few people that way. Other ways is people who've joined, and they sort of, in fact, we have got a new musician who's joined, and he brought a load of his friends in for one open day, about 10 of them. I thought, yes, brilliant. They do ballroom dancing or something, whatever. We showed them a dance, they got involved, they seemed to enjoy it. That's the last we saw of them. Because that night, it's Monday nights, is their ballroom night, so they, no, sorry, we can't do Monday nights. Traditionally, we do, sides have a particular night when they practice, you see, or they go out and dance, and Mondays is always Shakespeare's, and possibly it's because it was their night, or whatever, or they just didn't fancy it. You know, it wasn't ballroom dancing, is more defined and sort of refined and whatever. Sort of hopping around, waving your hankies and clashing people with sticks is probably, they think, is not dignified enough.
So how else has the group considered?
Oh, well, good old interwebnet. We've got websites, not websites, well, yeah, I've got a website, but Facebook is, we got a couple of things on Facebook, and we post what we've been doing and what we're going to do and pictures of what we've done and all this sort of stuff. And so we advertise on that quite heavily. And there's also quite a few other Morris bulletin boards, for want of a better term, on Facebook, which again you sort of share your information and pass it on. And also we go out and dance with other sides. Now, quite often in the old days, the sides didn't mix. They didn't sort of invite another side to come and dance on their patch, because it was their patch. You know, anything they got out of that patch, money, beer, food, whatever, you know, it's theirs. But once you want to be more social, oh yeah, come on, dance, and well, so-and-so's coming to dance. Oh right, well, we'll contact so-and-so. Oh right, and suddenly you've got three sides there, sort of dancing. And if the pub's happy about it, you know, they sort of might give you a free pint or whatever, you know. So it's a lot more social than it used to be, Morris dancing. There are a couple of sides around who are still very protective of their areas. They think if you go and dance in their area or their village or whatever, you haven't asked permission. What's this disgusting etiquette?
So overall, the mixing is better?
Oh, yes.
Or more challenging?
You've got to be more dedicated to do it. Because there's less people, like if you go and dance in a village, let's say, you might be dancing, well, Bidford, for example, that's where our tradition comes from. We danced there a couple of weeks ago. I think we got about four people actually watching us in the entire village. We danced in two places, but that was in the evening. Perhaps they're not home or whatever. But one of the problems is some of the village you go to, if you go and dance in the evening, it's a dead village anyway, because they're all second homes. So there's no one there. The people don't like, oh, let's go down the pub, and they're wandering down the high street or whatever to go to the pub, and they meet a load of Morris dancers there, so, and watch them, you know, it doesn't happen.
So do you find that a lot of people are surprised that you're there?
Yes.
On events?
Yeah, yeah. And they sort of, it's only one time we would dance on the Bancroft, this woman was sort of like walking towards me, and I was in the horse, and I was sort of saying, "Hello, how are you? You like Morris dancing?" "Oh, it's disgusting," she says. "It's disgusting." I'm sorry. What's disgusting? "Men dancing like that. It's disgusting." What's wrong with that? Anyways, they're enjoying themselves, aren't they? She wandered up. I've only met one like that. Mostly they sort of, if you invite, because we invite people in to dance as well at the end of our set, and you say, "Come on down, anyone, you know, hold a stick, you know, embarrass your father, you know, take a picture of your mother or whatever." And you can see some are like, yeah, it gets you, entice them in, and they have a go. But some, they want to go, but they just, it's peer pressure. They don't know, you know, it's not right, it's not, yeah. It's too silly.
Where do you see it going in the future?
It's happening now. It's where you used to have separate sides in different villages, and all the people in that side were drawn from that village. That's not the case anymore. Now you actually have, say, you have two separate Morris sides in name. Half of each are actually a member of the other side. Sometimes they're a member of a third side as well. In fact, the magic, the Morris Ring, which is the sort of overseeing, they don't regulate really, but they sort of keep an eye on Morris matters and things. One of the bagmen in that, currently he's a bagman for about five sides. We make fun of him, you know, who are you dancing for this week, you know, which badge have you got on, you know, and he tells you to go away. But so the sides are made up of people who actually share their time to other sides, which is a problem, because if you go into an event and you say, right, this event coming up this weekend coming, for example, this side's going, we've invited them, we've invited this side, we've invited this side. Have we got enough men and ladies to actually put on a side, put on a team? Yes, we have got. Oh, no, I can't do that because I'm dancing with so-and-so and they're also invited. And, I can't make it either because I'm dancing with so-and-so because they're invited. So you think, well, which is your primary side, you know? And you can't really say, you should be with that, because that puts people's backs up and they might just leave and you never see them again, which has happened with one side I know of, where one guy, he turned up and he was actually dancing the two sides that were there, and because they've got two different kits, he was trying to be like, well, what do I wear? Well, I'll wear the trousers for that one, and I can quickly, because they both had white shirts, and I can wear the hat and thing for that one. So during the changeover, he sort of swapped his bits over. And afterwards, the guy in charge of that particular side took him to one side and ripped him off, you know, his ear off, and said, look, you can't be, when you're appearing, you can't appear with those colour trousers, you know, it's the wrong trousers. And he didn't, and the guy explained why, because he's in both flipping sides and he couldn't change halfway between the two. But it was so annoying to this particular chap. He said, "Oh, I've resigned. I won't bother dancing with you anymore. I'll stay with this side."
So yeah. It's a lot. It comes across as people's a lifestyle for people.
Yes, I suppose it is, because sometimes you can make fun, or you know, social fun of somebody or whatever, and they take it umbrage, like, "How dare you such poor scorn on this side, we've been dancing and so on." "Oh, sorry, I was only just a little joshing joke, you know, I didn't really." Oh dear. Some people do teach it to be take it to be very, very precious, and you cannot change a thing. You cannot change the dances, the steps, the music, the outfits you wear, you know, it's got to be this because that's how it's laid down. As other sides, they say, "Well, we can't really dance this anymore. You know, so and so, he's too old. He can't prance too much. We'll have to take that bit out of the dance." Okay. Well, that means the music doesn't fit. "Oh, well, you have to modify the music. So now that dance, yeah, we can do it." And you call it the same dance. And then somebody, an onlooker who knows what the original was, sees this and goes, "You what? You can't do that. That's that's not right, it's not traditional. You know, other people say, well, it's other sides who have set up, non-traditional sides, they do their own dances, they do their own, take dances from different traditions and put them together to suit them. So it's sort of...
There was one thing I haven't asked you about. I went through the costume that you've made up yourself for the tawny horse, but I noticed you've also brought in a tankard.
Ah, yes, the
What's
most
the
important
story
piece.
The tankard?
You're not a Morris man unless you've got a tankard. Or lady. Well, it's for drinking beer, of course. When you go along to any event, it normally involves going to a pub. And if you go into a pub, you all queue up, thousands of you, and they've run out of glasses. Or you can't take the glasses outside, or they give you one of these horrible floppy plastic glasses. So you take your own tankard. Now, your own tankard, one tankard mostly looks like another tankard. And when you put it on the floor, when you're dancing or doing whatever you're doing, you know, people might take up your beer or kick it over. And then once it's kicked over, it says, oh, someone's been, beer's kicked over. Whose beer was it? Oh, I don't know. They're all the tankards are the same. So there's quite a few individual tankards. Individualistic in terms of some have got lids on them, some have got sort of their copper, some have got different badges and etchings and sort of accoutrements. Some have got like leather peaches put on them and things. This particular one, it's one I purchased because it's the Falklands. That's what it says on the Falklands. Argentinian invasion, 2nd of April 1982. And surrender 14th of June 1982, and it's got a etching of HMS Invincible on it, and Port Stanley, and the Falkland Islands, and the arms of the islands. It's also got on it some helicopters, and that's what I used to be working on, and Invincible, sort of. Although I was on a Royal Fleet Auxiliary when I went down there, I didn't get onto a proper Navy ship until after it had finished.
So this, like everything else you've told me today, is a personal story.
Yes, this is a personal
story.
Why
you're wearing it with the horse.
Yes, yeah.
So how does it make you feel when you wear these all individual things themselves? Proud? Just enjoy it?
Well, it's just, I suppose you're wearing your wearing your life on your... patch on your like a patch on the sleeve, you know, you're just sort of like advertising all the weird and wonderful things you've got up to, like on the hats, you know, you've got the Shakespeare Mama badge, you've got different pubs here, Bull Baiters, Ale and Cider House, Isle of Man, so I sort of do motorcycling, Parachute Regiment, sort of the sort of I Stand With Soldier F and things, Royal Navy, and what else we've got in here, yeah. So it's basically personalising things however you feel, and there's nothing really, the only thing I have been told off about wearing, none of the badges, because you've got like Lone May Day Morris there and the Morris Ring badges and Morris Festivals, so they're happy, they're Morris. I've got this, I've been told off for this is the illustrious Fools and Beasts badge, because I shouldn't actually have that on my shirt at all, but I told him what you can do about it. because I'm being with the beast, as it were. You know, you have the illustrious order of fools and beasts, and so the fool, they've got the badge on their shirt. So I thought, well, why can't I put a badge on my shirt? Prior to that, on the back of the sash. Normally, you only ever have a certain couple of things on the baldric. You've got Shakespeare's coat of arms, which you're allowed to wear. You've got the coat of arms of the Stratford-upon-Avon, which this badge was given to us by the mayor when we dance in front of them. He actually passed them out to us, so that's quite nice. I should have another badge on here which says Captain of Mummers, but the paint's fallen off and it's being repainted at the moment. But on the other thing you can have is like the Edifice badge, the Folk Dance and Folk Song Society badge. You can have that; that's allowed. Or if you've got a Squire's badge. But on the back, what I've done, where's it gone? I've put a horse, a horse's head, because I'm the horse. And someone said, "You can't have anything. You can't have that on the back. And I said, well, why not? You know, I'm the horse. I'm not a musician, so I haven't got a musician's tabard. I'm not a dancer. I haven't got the leg pads, the bell pads. And none of you have got a horse. So, you know, I'll just stick that on. So for about a year, I just had it pinned on, and then I sewed it on, and put the fools and beasts on. So they just... Oh.
So would you say that you conform, or you're a rebel?
Oh, rebel. Well, you got to be a bit
Tim,
rebellious.
Tim, thank you very, very much indeed. Absolute pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.